There would be something really quite funny if both of us had, because like I now have the Discord up like on my main monitor next to the podcast recording thing, and I can see the same picture of Adrian Childs that you're looking at.
Yeah.
So both of us are talking to a picture of Adrian Childs at this point.
Let's see what that does for the vibe. Like maybe that's. You know.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Shut Up and Sit Down podcast, a podcast about board games, and the people who love board games. I'm joined today, as always, and sometimes, and often, by Ava Foxfort.
I can't be all of those things at once, but I do love board games.
I thought you were going to say, but you do try.
I do try.
To be temporarily inconsistent.
Yes, yes. Always, sometimes, maybe, be my, call my... Carly Rae Jepsen.
On this podcast, we're going to talk about three games. We're going to talk about Panchaya. Oh, I know, I've realized something, Ava. As I'm just about to launch straight into a fun intro, I don't know what either of your two games are about.
So I'm going to be like, I have secrets.
Maybe you should do the games. Well,
I don't know what your game is about. Actually, no, I kind of do. I mean, I don't.
Yeah, let's take a swing at it. Let's take a swing.
Okay, so today we're going to be talking about three games and maybe having a little chat about reviewing processes. First, we're going to be talking about Panchaya, which is a tile-laying game about building a village in India made by a company that is based in Goa. We will also be talking about Kingsbridge, which is a card game based on... A novel by Ken Follett.
Right.
And like, I don't know what to do with that, but we'll get to that in a small bit. Finally, Tom has been taking a look at Sky Mines, which, if I'm not mistaken, and if I am mistaken, I know nothing about this game, is a like re-do-over of Mombasa, which is a classic Vista colonial builder.
Yeah, correct. Ding, hey! Ding, ding. 10 points. Yeah. Ava, you've been playing a little bit of a little game called Panchayat.
I have, and it's a nice little game about building a little village out of tiles. Now, that's the sort of thing that you will have heard us say before, and like, there's a boring way of explaining this game that makes it sound like about 20 other games at least. So we're going to start with that. And then we're going to get to the spice. Okay, so in this game, you are selecting tiles that you're going to put into a grid. When you place them, you will get bonuses depending on where you've put them. There's a river at the top. There's a farm at the side. Some things want to be next to the river. Some things want to be next to the farm. Some things want to be away from those things. And some things want to be next to or away from the other buildings you're placing. This means that you're just trying to lay out a grid with pleasing... town buildings that score from each other and get the things that you want to do the thing, right? You've heard of that game before, Tom.
I've played this game before.
You have played this game before. However,
oh.
Technically it's quite mild spice, but I actually did really quite like it. The interesting thing that's going on here is exactly how you select those tiles. You are going to be selecting two tiles per turn to go into your town. That's already nice because it means you might be able to hit a combo immediately. Okay, that's good. That's something. However, at the beginning of each turn, you will reveal three tiles. So, oh, you're leaving a tile behind. Ah, but no, Tom, actually, you're not just leaving one tile behind, and three tiles isn't enough to choose two tiles from, because what if two of them are rubbish? Well.
Well.
I've really overbuilt up to this. With this game... there's a row of new tiles that are the three that you put out each turn. And below that, there are three different older building tiles. And these are actually a stack of tiles. It's almost like three discard piles, although there is also a separate discard pile somewhere else, so you're not really allowed to call it that. Any tiles that you don't take from the top row will get put onto the bottom row on top of tiles that are already there. So, and you can take from the top of those tiles. And
yep.
You can place on any of the stacks of tiles that are there, as long as there's not an empty space. You've always got to fill up the empty space first. But if you put the fourth tile on a stack, everything else in that stack goes.
Right.
So while all you are doing is picking two tiles a turn and then like moving some tiles down onto other ones, you end up with a surprising amount of interesting control about what is going to be available to other people. And potentially, if you're really lucky or really canny, or maybe playing at two players where that stuff always tends to be more interesting, that you might be able to get back yourself later. So this isn't like fiddly or complicated or clever, but it's something that I've not quite seen in this form before. And it is just enough to like elevate this game a bit for me. And I found it like, we all found it really satisfying to play.
It sounds like it has a bit of zhuzh. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there is some zhuzh in there. Like it is not doing anything revolutionary. Like honestly, within this field, this game has the problem of it is up against Suburbia, which is probably one of the like funniest boring games in the world.
And one of the all-time greats of I'm going to build this thing next to this thing and it's going to score me more points because of my nice planning, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This is exactly that. This Pantrea is an order of magnitude simpler than that, but also doesn't have that like spicy interest of you build something and you real like the buildings don't have quite enough character to become like the weird town planning satire that Suburbia is.
Right.
But also I was kind of a bit disappointed that there didn't seem to be enough in there that was like specifically around Indian culture. Like Clio Games say on their website that like they're really interested in making games that are family friendly and welcoming to a large range of people and still really interesting for adult gamers who like might want to play with their kids and introduce you to the culture of India in interesting ways. And I just feel like there was one really interesting combo of buildings that I think taught me a little bit about village life, but the rest of it felt a touch generic, a touch like, oh yeah, no, I guess the tea house does want to be near to the cow shed so that they can get the milk easier, right?
Yeah,
but
it
didn't feel like specifically anything, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, because to some extent it's actually really good to like just recognize that cultures all around the world have a lot of things in common rather than a lot of things in difference. But yeah, there's honestly, I feel like it's like a tightly game with just enough wrinkles to make it interesting. It's very hard to recommend to someone who's already got a load of games like this. And yeah. I don't even know whether it would be the game that I would put like first on your list if you're interested in that type of thing. But, oh, it's so solid. It's so solid.
I had this problem when we talked about, because immediately I'm looking at Pantrea and thinking that it's a two-player game, but it does go up to four. Hmm. But I feel like there's something about that, like that shared kind of river of options that you're sort of discarding into that would make it maybe most interesting at two players. Maybe I'm wrong in that assessment.
No, I think definitely, like, you know, as I alluded to, like there is the thing where if you are playing with two players, when you put something into one of those stacks, you might be making it so that you can get it next turn. If you're playing with three or four players, that is not going to be the case.
No. I feel like a lot of these games do really like, especially when you can, it's something that I've seen a lot when playing Innovation recently, even though it's a very different kind of game. Mm-hmm. But like games that can go up to four that are best at two is like a huge subcategory of board games. And this seems like exactly one of those where that sort of like, it's like I've been playing lots of Trailblazers recently. I think we're going to talk about that on the next podcast. Oh, cool. And that has a draft that's really like lethal at two players, but a little bit messy and like fuzzy at more than that, at three or four.
Yeah.
or up to eight, I believe Trailblazers goes.
I think it's a hard thing, but like that is also a way that you can like change the vibe of a game, because like I think really that can actually be, if we're talking about family games, that can often be a really nice thing, because if you can make it like a bit less cutthroat when you go above two players, then that means like a couple of parents, a couple of adults can play together and play like the like nasty version, the clever version, and then you
the spiteful
can,
version.
The spiteful version, and then you can get bring the kids in, and then like you soften the edges of that a little bit.
Yeah.
So
I haven't thought of it that way.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's making a lot of presumptions about like what the shape of your family and who wants to do things and like how much you don't like your adult partner.
How nasty your children are.
Or how nasty your children are. But yeah, like, I think that there is something in that. It also has a single player mode. I haven't tried it, but it exists. And it is the sort of thing that it's a pleasing enough puzzle that I imagine that there is some interest in it, because, yeah, it's a little bit of a brain tickler. Like, it is not going to make you, like, cogitate for hours and, like, stress about what's happening and what's coming up. Moves are quite often going to be obvious. But really, there's, like, a clear thing saying, oh yeah, here are all of the points and buildings that are available, here are all of the combos available. And to some extent, it's like, are you going to push your luck on hoping that you're going to find the tile that you want, or are you going to just put the thing in now? It's all really, really simple decisions, but there is enough of them and they are interesting enough. It's got a like race for cowsheds thing that I think makes it really interesting, because whoever has the most cowsheds at the end of the game gets an extra 10 points. Which is like a lot of points. Like, I think our scores were about like 60 odd points or so. And like,
yeah, big swing.
Yeah, 10 points can be a big swing. And there's only 6 of them in the game, I think. And that means that, like, if you can have a turn where you get 2 of them and bury one, you're almost definitely getting those points. Right,
you bury only a cow.
Bury as in, well, no, don't bury cows. No, if you bury the tile by like putting it into the discard pile in a way that gets rid of it. You see, this is what makes that little spicy market dynamic really interesting, is that there is a really strong benefit to hiding something from someone or moving it away, but also there's ways to open up. Oh, I'm getting excited thinking about it, which is interesting because to a large extent, when I was playing this afterwards, the general conclusion was like, oh, that was really nice. I really enjoyed that. I might never play it again. I might never remember it to play it again. I might not really think about it that much again. And that's so harsh and like and very unfair. Like, this is mostly because I played a lot of games rather than anything else. But yeah, I think that it's, now that I'm thinking about solid. It, I'm like, yeah, this is a solid little puzzle. This is something that I'm enjoying, and I would never turn down a game of it. It's going to be quick enough that I wouldn't need to, right?
That's the thing. I definitely think there is a tendency within like board gamers as a collective, and especially us as people who are reviewing board games, to very much not be content to sort of just sit down to a nice game that we like, which sounds ridiculous, but it's like true. Where I was talking to Quinns the other day, and we didn't necessarily have something that was leaping out on the sort of in tray to play, and I said, you know, we could just play a game of Concordia, and he went, and it's like, but you love Concordia. Yeah. It's like your favorite thing. But there is like a huge part of our sort of brains that is predisposed to be like, we've played this already, we've seen what it has to offer, even though if we did sit down and play it again, we'd have a lovely time.
Yeah, I know. And I think it is actually genuinely like a really sad thing about like getting into board game reviews. And it's not even that, because I did this before. Like, I am really excited about new things. Like, my favorite bit of a game is learning a new thing. Like,
yes.
Even learning how to teach something can be really exciting. Even playing something and deciding it's rubbish can be exciting to me. Like, that's a thing that I'm like hungry for, that diving into a new thing. But like, the simplest pleasure in board games is like playing something that you've played before and everyone knows it, and you are all just able to kind of like sit back and enjoy that thing. I don't know if I've already talked about this on a podcast, but I went to Aircon recently and I played a game of Castles of Burgundy with some people, one person who I'd been playing that game with repeatedly online over the pandemic and hadn't seen in person in that time, and one person who I'd only just met, but who I'd met like a little bit before the pandemic. And we sat down and we played a game where we all knew the rules. We all understood everything that was going on. We'd all played it to death. We could see exactly what each other was doing. And it was like the sweetest, meditative and like beautiful expression of something that I've had in such a long time. Because it's just like, oh, just getting to enjoy the game. Like, make sure you do it, Tom. Like, don't fall into the trap of only playing the new things. Like, make sure that you sit down, especially with like those heavy Euro games that kind of like pound your brain a bit, or those medium heavy Euro games that kind of you can always get there. But like, when you get to play them and you just know it, It's such a lovely vibe. And I've been trying to make sure I get more of that in my life.
I think that's maybe like with campaign games, like big chunky dungeon crawlers, part of the appeal, the secret appeal that people love about those games maybe is the fact that they already know it when they turn up to game night. Like it's something that isn't talked about because it's like, well, the main thing is, you know, all these fancy campaign features and progression and stuff. But it is a simple joy of coming back to something that everyone knows already.
That's like the ideal compromise between the two drives that we've just been talking about. Like the drive to play a game that you've played before and you understand and you can get into it.
Yeah.
Which also gives you a new experience and lets you dig into something new and exciting. Like, that's the dream. So yeah, but I never play campaign games because I find it really hard to convince people to do the same thing for enough times. And if I can, I want to play an RPG with them. Oh no,
I find it hard to get people to come to my house just once, let alone like 30 times.
Tom, I mean, like, you know, I think there are things you can do about your house to make it less unpleasant for people.
First off, the smell.
So there's also another game that I've been playing that might be in the category of like, oh, I kind of like that, but I don't know what's exciting enough about it to say, oh, this is a great game. But that is a game that, oh my word. Okay, Kingsbridge, the game, is based on a Ken Follett novel. Ken Follett being a historical fiction writer who your dad probably picks up a Ken Follett book every time he goes through an airport, Tom?
Is he the Andy McNab of the olden days?
Yes, yes, yeah. He's Andy McNab, but for Vikings.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, I mean, that's not entirely true. He's actually like Andy McNab, but for building cathedrals, I think. If I understand
the
correctly.
Andy McNab of civic infrastructure.
Yes. There's a couple of games based on books by him, and I think it's one of these things where there's a certain kind of vibe of person who loves a gentle card game, loves a boring historical fiction book. That's harsh. I don't know whether they're any good or not.
I think you're that person.
You'd think so. Oh god, no, I am probably going to be, actually, to be fair. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's an appeal to this. However,
okay,
this game is unusual.
That's a great quote for the box. There's an appeal to this. Even Fox 4, shut up and sit down.
Honestly, Tom, like, just wait, because this isn't even like the most specific thing about this game.
Okay.
Kingsbridge, the game, is essentially multiplayer patience.
Okay.
Okay. What you are doing is you put some cards down and they have to go in order. So you have to, I can't remember whether you have to go from low to high or you have to go from high to low, but you know, you have to do one of
those. It looks like low to high in the one image I can see of this game in play.
Okay, Tom, I just want to jump in and say the justification for that in the manual is because you are trying to tell the story of the novel, and like it has a line which is something along the lines of like, all of the cards have to go in order, just like the carefully planned plots of Ken Follett's novel, whatever the name of the novel is, so much. It also means that, like, technically the cards of this game, like, are a spoiler for the novel.
Right.
Because they tell the entire plot of the novel over the course of all of the cards in the run as just like a sequence of events. Like, it's just like the historical events of like, oh, this person just got married, and oh no, this person has betrayed X person. It's a little bit odd. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now at this point, looking through the manual, looking through the cards, I was not expecting anything wonderful. However,
right,
Tom, why do you think I persisted?
Because you like telling a little story with your friends?
I mean, I do, but that's not why. I don't like necessarily telling the story of a Ken Follett novel with my friends.
I have no idea. Why did you persist?
Have you still got the box in front of you? Can you see whose name is on that box?
It's Mr. Kramer, right?
I thought it was the other one.
It's definitely Kramer.
Is it? I think it's Wolfgang
Kramer.
Isn't it Wolfgang Walsh?
No, it's Wolfgang Kramer.
Oh, no. Are you sure?
It says Wolfgang Kramer on Board Game Geek. This is staying in.
I'm just going to go and get my copy of the box because I don't trust Board Game Geek, and I'm going to sound like a complete idiot when I come back.
Ava has Mandela affected herself into believing that this box.
Tom, it says Wolfgang Kramer. Well, all I can say is that Wolfgang Kramer was really channeling the spirit of Wolfgang Wash.
Okay, so fresh with the knowledge that it's designed by a different Wolfgang, what's this game? What is it? Is it good? Did you enjoy it now that you know that it's not your favourite Wolfgang?
Okay, so like I mean, maybe this changes my mind about who my favourite Wolfgang is, because I'll be honest with you. So the thing that I think about Wolfgang Wash is that he's designed a couple of brilliant games, but he's also like jumped in on a couple of designs to like add interesting cards to them. Like, I think there's this thing where he has this smartness with like player powers and unique abilities that I feel like that was why he was brought onto the team for the Fuzzies, right?
Yes.
Because he designed the cards to go with like a quite basic like moving of blobs up the board to try and give a little wrinkle to it. And I feel like there's been...
And that's why he wasn't brought on for Kingsbridge the Game?
And that's why I thought he was brought on for Kingsbridge the Game. Because it's also like the event cards in Quacks of Quedlingburg are like the best event cards in any game. Like normally it's mm-hmm. really irritating when there's something at the beginning of the turn that is giving you like a wrinkle for that particular turn. And those cards absolutely nail it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kingsbridge is fundamentally a game of patience. You are making stacks of cards. You're allowed to move some cards out of the way by putting them onto another thing when they can still be consecutive. So on your turn, you're trying to get rid of as much of your hand of cards as possible whilst organizing the board. Okay. That is, that's actually quite nice because it is incredibly simple and anyone can do it. This fact that you are, trying to get rid of your cards. There's an opportunity. There's options to do it cooperatively. There's options to do it competitively, but it's not. It doesn't feel like a game. It feels like something you could be doing with like any deck of cards you've ever had as a pastime. However, you have a little stack of character cards, characters from the books of Ken Follett, who each have a little wrinkly power. And if you are playing competitively, whenever you use the one, you can only use it once per turn. But at the end of the turn, when you use it, you put it to the bottom of your neighbor's stack of cards.
Huh.
So these things give you the ability to like skip a number or add an extra place to put cards or move something into a new pile or just break and bend and manipulate the rules. Like you might be like setting a little trap for someone else or just like removing some cards from the game because that's going to be easier and maybe get in someone's way later. Like, these are all really, really, really simple special powers, but they are just enough to turn this into a game that, like, I actually do want to go back to. And, like, I really didn't think I'd be saying that about a game of competitive patience set in a Ken Follett novel.
About a Viking tie-in game. Yeah. No, okay.
Yeah, that's all I have to say. This is not a game that is going to blow your mind. This might be the perfect gift for the Ken Follett loving granddad in your life.
Yes.
Or me. But I've already got
or
it.
You.
So don't worry, because like maybe I'm the only person who is weirdly, really weirdly into this kind of
listeners of the podcast
fine game.
Send Ava copies of Kingsbridge the Game.
Oh just no, it just becomes that thing like, where like every time I think I've just received a present from someone, it turns out it's a copy of...
It's another copy of Kingsbridge. You'll start to be able to identify a package, the exact weight and dimensions of another Kingsbridge.
Immediately just throwing boxes on the bin unopened because I'm pretty sure that it's just got Kingsbridge in it. Like,
this is my board game collection and this is my room stacked to the ceiling with Kingsbridge the Games.
But this is a thing, right, Tom? Is like I kind of wanted to have a little chat of it, and we kind of previewed this a little bit already. But like, what's the hardest type of game to talk about on a podcast or do a review of, Tom? Honestly,
it's the games that are like a good but unremarkable, right? Yeah. Like games that are solid and enjoyable, but lack a sort of like a spritz that makes them kind of interesting to talk about, or games that you feel like the ultimate like. At the end of a conversation about a game, you say, but I'd rather play X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
We come up with this a lot because of the fact that, you know, we've got quite big collections of games, but realistically, like, how many board games does the average person need? Like, you know, if you are a big fan of board games, you could probably do a collection in like 25 games and have 25 games that you could be set to play for the next like 10 years. Because, you know, ideally the best mode to play board games in is that mode we talked about earlier, where you have really solid games that you know really well and you play with people who like them. And that's it. You don't need this voracious appetite for new. And so games that are new but unremarkable or new but replaceable are often really like the trickiest thing for us to cover, generally speaking, because I don't know. I always feel like I end the conversation by being like, yes, good. Play it once and then never again. And that's such a rubbish conclusion to have, isn't it?
Yeah. And like, I also don't know with some of these games, you know, when we're going for reviews, like, we play enough to make sure that we know that like this isn't going to get boring or stale after a couple of plays. But like something like this might be something that like immediately the like next game of it I play, I'm just like, oh wait, there's nothing here. Or it could be something that like, I'm still happy enjoying in a decade because I am now the biggest fan of Ken Follett in the world, and it really makes me happy to play with my 100 copies of Kingsbridge. But that's not very likely. But I don't know. I think it is tricky. I think you've like hit the nail on the head with all of that, because it is just, I'm really, really like playing games. I really like discovering new games, but yeah, if I had any ruthlessness in my body, I would probably be willing to get rid of like 200 of the board games that I have in my board game cupboard.
Whoa.
Because I think that for most things, I can be like, you know what? This is something that I know will last reliably for a long time and I will always be interested in. And if I was just looking for, can I just play games with a wide enough variety of people, can I have a game for every situation, I wouldn't need that many games. Now,
yes,
I love showing new things to people. I love explaining things to people. I love diving into new things. So that's probably not realistically going to happen. But yeah, how do you compete? How do you compete in that field? And like, when you are new to board games, I don't know. If either of these games were like the first game that I ever got, I would probably be weirdly happy, right? Mm. I think we said this about, yes, Court of Miracles last year. It's like, if this had been like my introduction to modern board games, I would have been so excited about that. But from our perspective, it was also like, oh yeah, no, that was really nice. And
yeah,
not necessarily a huge amount of excitement.
I think a thing that I really benefit from in that kind of way is a lot of what you think about games depends on who you play it with. And the people who I'm playing games with at the moment are people who know that we are sort of trying to review them. They're people who I play games with understand that like the purpose of our session is to somewhat like unpick a game or kind of talk collectively about how we feel about it while we're playing it. And because we play so many games, they've got that same kind of impulse as me to like try and understand where this game fits in the sort of grand scheme of things. And I think that's healthy to some extent, but also like maybe not that useful when it comes to like the average person who wants to play a cool new game. And so like a lot of the time I went to the pub last night and just introduced a bunch of people to Cockroach Poker, and that kind of like excitement about like a new game, or seeing that kind of like first time love of like, oh wow, this is what board games can be, is very useful in sort of putting a sort of spring in your critical step to remind you that like these games exist so that they can be people's like first game, or they can be a game that kind of onboards them into this greater hobby. They don't need to necessarily be, you know, appease someone who's played so many bloody games at this point. And I don't know, like, it's hard because my interior voice is saying, well, then why would you recommend that stuff over the, you know, the sort of what you perceive as the heights of games, what you perceive as the kind of like the I was going to say top shelf material, but that is definitely not the right turn of phrase.
Top shelf Ken Follett.
And I actually don't know. Like, I don't know what the answer to that is. Like, whether you should, like, if someone is new to games, like, do you recommend them the thing that is like the easy onboard, or do you recommend them the thing that is like the very best? Because if you recommend them the very best, maybe they're more likely to stick around if they do enjoy that thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I think that one of the things that you've just always got to remember at the core of like all of this discussion is just like everybody's really different. Everybody's really excited by different things. Like, I'm sure I want to just like frankly apologize to anyone in the audience who absolutely adores Ken Follett, because like I've just been gently ribbing him. I've not read his books. I understand that they are incredibly successful and loads of people really love them. And like, yeah, he has made, like one of his most famous books, I think, is Pillars of the Earth, which also has a board game made after it that is highly successful. Not the video game called Pillars of the Earth. That's entirely different. And it is like, it's a historical novel about like a cathedral being built over several hundred years. And it's like, you know what? That's cool. That's cool. And for some people, like, yeah, games that are good enough to be enjoyed, like, deserve a bit of love, because each one of them could be something that someone picks up because they're not interested in board games, but because they're interested in a topic, because they're interested in a theme, because they, like, just want to see something about this, or they want to get a present for their friend who likes Ken Follett, or... And all of these things, like, they're a great part of the hobby, because that's a way that you get new people in. You know, I was brought in to board games largely by people. Well, I mean, to be fair, I was brought into board games by wanting to play board games. But like, and actually, I was brought into Game of Thrones by playing a board game. But also, yeah, if you're excited about something, if you know someone who's going to be excited by something, then check that the game isn't bad or doesn't have big things to off-put it. But yeah, go out and find those things that you love, because you will have a lot more luck getting people to play games if you can find something that excites them rather than that excites like bedraggled, grizzled games critics who are like finding fault in everything because we've seen so much that you can only see faults.
I remember very vividly, I absolutely rambled to someone. They said, hey, I've got a friend who's kind of new to board games. They're interested in board games. We don't know anything about board games, but we want to buy them a board game for their birthday. What should we get them? And then I rambled a bunch about all these different options for what board game to get them. And they said, okay, we bought him Photosynthesis because it's green. and he likes green. And it's like, yeah, like that. There is an element of that. Like with some people will pick up on a game that they love for reasons that you can't like, you know, necessarily pin down and dissect critically.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think like, I always think about my partner just absolutely loves the board game Corrosion, and I still don't entirely understand. Well, I do understand why. It's great. But then when I'm like, well, can't we play something that's the next step up, a little bit more complex, a little bit weirder? And she's like, no, I just like Corrosion. Let's just play that again.
Yeah.
Also, this discussion has given me the idea that we need to do a Ken Follett special where we review all the Ken Follett games.
Oh my God, yeah. If someone can send me a copy of Pillars of the Earth, I am well up for some cathedral building Follett, hot Follett action.
Let's make it happen. So our last game on this podcast is Sky Mines. This comes to us from Deep Print Games, and it's designed by Alexander Pfister, who you might know from Great Western Trail, or did he do Isle of Skye?
Yep, yeah, Isle of Skye. So. Oh my good.
Broom Service.
Broom Service, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's done a lot of games.
And Sky Mines is actually a re-implementation of an older Alexander Pfister game called Mombasa, which was a slightly, probably quite problematic game about doing a bit of colonialism. So don't worry, it's been rethemed as Sky Mines, where you're trying to mine a Krip coin on the moon. So we've gone from a colonialist theme to a cryptocurrency tech bro theme.
Oh no.
Which I'm not jazzed about. It's not the worst theme, and it fades into the background pretty quickly. But yeah, slightly strange jump in theme there. So outside of the theme, I was also a little bit worried going into this game. I have not been a huge fan of recent Alexander Pfister games. I played Great Western Trail Argentina most recently, which I found a bit lacking in reason to actually play over the base game. We played Boon Lake, which I thought was a little too hard on the kind of... the excess of an end game of a euro. You know when your engine is kind of complete and you can churn out points? Boon Lake, that's like half the game. is the sort of wallowing in the fun excess of being able to pump that slot machine over and over and over. And oh boy, I found it a little tedious. And we also struggled with Cloud Age, which is this sort of big, messy sort of Euro game and campaign thing that didn't quite blend together. And so Skymines had been sat on my shelf for months and months and months without being played because I wasn't anticipating that it was going to be that good. But, Ava, I was pleasantly surprised.
Hey! I was really expecting that to be a but. This also wasn't that good.
That would have been exceptionally cruel after ragging on a bunch of Vista games in a row and then further dunking on Skymines. Oh, yeah. So, first off, I want to talk about the fact that Deep Print do such a good job with their manuals. Skymines sat on my shelf because it's super intimidating, like big, chunky box. I did that thing where I sort of opened it up and sorted all the components. It took me ages. There's so much iconography. The manual is thick. And I was like, oh no, I'm scared. But it's actually like, it's this weird mesh where I kept describing it as a simple, complex Euro game. Like, it is this big knot of systems that you want. It does make you crunch and think, and it has got bonkers iconography and loads of tracks and little weird mini games. But the teach took me like 20 minutes, 15 minutes, something like that. Well, and I was doing it pretty leisurely and I covered everything.
Yeah. Did you still have to write a separate document just for yourself?
Maybe.
Yeah, no.
No, I didn't. I wrote like four things on a post-it note.
Wow. And
like, then I did my teach, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, wow. What a way for me to like assess the complexity of a game is how many notes did Tom need to take before teaching it?
Yeah, it's definitely skewed because I take a lot of notes to teach complicated games. I definitely remember early on when I worked for Shut Up and Sit Down, I was so keen to impress everyone that I was like a good, honest, hardworking boy that I made like... I basically rewrote the manual for Beyond the Sun so that I could teach it to people over TTS. I remember that very vividly. Yeah. It was like an 8-page manual. Oh, it was dear. Just me doing it in, silly times, times.
You are really good at teaching, though, as a result of this. And I suspect that the longer you keep on doing that, the less and less you'll have to write because, yeah, I don't know.
I think it also depends on how the manual is laid out because the way that the Deep Print do their manuals is they have like a really lovely color-coded system. And they do a lovely thing of being like, hey, here are the five things you can do on your turn. And then they show those five things in like red, blue, yellow, green. And then each page is color-coded to that action and you can find all the information you need about that action on those pages. So the way you structure the teach, this is very inside baseball, but the way that you structure teaching the game is really elegant because you literally have to go, we're not going to worry about how you start and end the round. We're just going to talk about the actions. You describe the actions and the game has basically been taught in that time. Very, very sleek bit of manual design working really, really well with game design. Anyway, let me tell you how the game works. You're going to play 7 rounds of Skymines and each round players are going to choose cards from their hand to place down in front of them. And then in turn order, they'll resolve those cards one at a time or multiple at a time in a thing I won't get into. The cards can be used in 5 different ways. And generally speaking, what they have on them is just a big picture of a resource. You can either use that resource to buy more cards, so you can have better cards with more resources to use in future rounds. You could advance up the stock tracks of these 4 companies that are sort of fighting for control of the moon. I kind of forgot to tell you that it was cryptocurrency on the moon, the game. Or you can use energy on energy cards to expand the reach of those companies on what is effectively an area control board in the middle of the table. At the end of the game, players are going to score points based on how many shares they have in the companies and how much space that those companies have taken up on the board, effectively. The other thing you can do is use scientist cards to play these little mini games on your board. So one scientist will fill up these tanks of helium, which is just a big long score tracker, or one kind of scientist will do research I won't get into that, but there's like this sort of contract fulfillment element where you socket these contracts onto your board and you can advance a little track around them. It's in the game, you're creating data and then uploading it to the cloud. Very strange.
I mean, presumably that's like actual NFT stuff, right? Like that's when you're...
You know, like, it doesn't lean too hard into that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're not like, drawing little moon apes.
Yeah, you're not drawing tiny doges on the board or something like that. Oh. You're not minting a monkey. But both of these actions might let you unlock new slots on your board to then play more cards per turn. But then here's the interesting thing. So this is all like just sounds like Eurogame. And it is. It's a really lovely blend of crunchy, thinky, numbers Euro game where you have resources and you need to allocate them correctly to do well, and a sort of area control game where you're fighting with your opponents to take control of the moon and sort of assert dominance on that side of things and hopefully be the person who owns the right stock in the right company at the right time. However, here's the action that I really like in this game. The cards that you play go in front of you on your little player board. And when you're done, you pick them up and you socket them on top of your player board in little piles. So there's three sockets under your board, and then there's five sockets on top of your board. And you put them like in little piles. However, obviously playing your cards, they're still going to be on the table. You take back piles of cards at the end of your turn, but only one pile a turn. So over the course of several turns, you're making these sort of mismatched piles that are going to like be different, but also kind of contain the plans for your next few turns. I'm explaining this so badly.
Oh, so like cards that you use on a turn, they will get spread out over different piles. So like you can put into something. So if you know you want to do something in like three turns, you have to start putting the things into that space for later, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
You're like sort of stashing your cards so that you know that when you pick up those cards later on, you've kind of got a ready-made set of actions for that turn. You're like planning your future turns with your discards.
Yeah.
It's very clever. And it's a really, really lovely system.
Does that feel like more organic or more interesting or less interesting than the Compass Rose Wheelie Rondle of Future Stress in Amsterdam/Macau?
Oh,
because that's what that's reminding me of, is like that game has a thing where at the beginning of a turn you take resources, but you can get more resources if you're willing to wait a few turns for them to show up. So the more you plan ahead, the more you can do on later turns.
Yes.
But does it have some of that vibe, or am I just like clutching at
It definitely has some of that vibe.
Yeah.
It definitely has some of that vibe because you are like seeding your future turns now. It's less immediate because it's less like Amsterdam and Macau or whatever is asking you the question of like, do you want loads of stuff now? Loads of stuff later or a little bit now? And that tension drives like a lot of that game.
Yeah.
This is different, but it still has a lot of that really like fantastic feeling of like when you pull it off. So like when you have planned three turns in a row to put the three exact cards you need for your third turn in a pile. Yeah. So you pick it up and then you know what your turn is straight away. That feels incredible. And on the flip side, it's a great game for like continually biting you in the ass.
Yeah.
Because you'll pick up that stack or you'll look at your stacks and be like, right, so what I need to do is expand this company, which means I need energy. So I'll take this pile. Oh, but I want to buy a card from the market and my really big money card is in this different pile. And you have to choose between those two options because you are a fool and you played yourself. And it incentivizes you to not just like play all your good cards in one turn because they have to be distributed across the next three pickups.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so clever.
That's really, really, really lovely, actually. I think I really, really like that. Because I think that there's a thing with Euro games, like a big part of doing well is about planning. And like,
yes,
there's often like not really a reward for that or not really a flag of that happening. And like, if you were like me and basically like fundamentally don't have a functional memory, like the entire game becomes about trying to remember the thing that you thought was a good idea three turns ago. Whereas if you've got this kind of like aid de memoir of like, you are saving those cards, you are putting them into a stack. So you've got something a bit more concrete on the table about what you're planning for yourself, but also for that satisfaction and also for the potential to bite you in the ass. Because you do need to be thinking about the cards that you have on the turn before the big turn that you're planning, because you need to make sure that you've got the card to put on the big turn that you're planning on that turn. And yeah, that's actually really nice. I'm into that.
Yeah. And there's loads of other, like, I think it's, at its core, it's a Euro game that just has very, very good internal planning with yourself, but also like on top of that, really good player interaction. You have a system that I haven't talked about where you get these little markers each turn that you can put down on these spaces on the board when you have the most of something. But obviously, you having the most of something it's not a constant. Like, it might change based on what cards you play or choose to not play on your turn. So you kind of have to bait out other people to use their cards. It's kind of hard to explain, but the player interaction is really pretty lethal.
Yeah.
And I think that juice on top of what is a really good internal like planning system is great. And Ava, I'd be remiss not to mention that earlier on we talked about campaign games and like evolving campaign games being something that, like, I think that you said, and this is, it was too perfect. You said something along the lines of the ideal is a game that, like, is really robust but also has a campaign, so you get the best of both worlds of having lots of people sat around a table and they know the system but also having additions to it. Skymines has like a 4-mission campaign that you can play as well, with a bunch of like bonus extra stuff. It kind of scares me a bit because that stuff I didn't love in some of the other Fister games, some of the other experiments, but I think I'm going to go away and give it a little go, and then if it's good, I'll report back.
Yeah.
We'll do a Skymines update.
Yeah. Oh, you've got me really hyped for Skymines, despite it being about cryptocurrency and not having any Ken Follett in it.
It's cryptocurrency on the moon, Ava.
Oh my God, but just imagine if it was about building cathedrals, Tom.
Just imagine.
Just imagine.
That is the end of this week's Shut Up and Sit Down podcast. We talked about a whole bunch of games, all of them pretty good. Mm. Maybe some of them not exceptional, but pretty good. Pretty interesting. Nice chats were had. Ava, I've sort of done something a little bit strange to myself during this podcast.
A what?
Which is, early on, maybe listeners might have heard or whatever, they might have heard the sound of a sort of like a little bottle of like this kind of sound. Don't know if anyone can hear that, of like little pills being opened. I realized I hadn't taken my multivitamin.
God, Tom, are you okay? Have you overdosed?
On the pod, live on air.
I may have done something a bit weird to myself here, and it's like, yeah, accidental snuff pod.
I took a little multivitamin out of the bottle and then I put it on the desk in front of me, and to remind myself to then have it later. But in my brain, like, you know when you like give your, like, you know, I used to do this when I was like younger and I couldn't do revision. I'd put like little Smarties out in front of me, and every time I finished like a bit of revision, I could have a Smartie. Aww. And now, like, my treat for finishing this podcast is to take my multivitamin, and like, I'm looking at it and my brain is going, oh, that's going to be tasty, you know? Like, there's something about this sort of like weird psychological response that's kind of making me quite excited to take a multivitamin. Is that weird?
I mean, like, yes, but like, so is everything. Like, just for the listeners at home, for reasons that I can't entirely explain, me and Tom are both looking at a picture of Adrian Childs while we do this part. And like,
and now you're imagining
maybe
Adrian
that's weird,
Childs snuffling up a multivitamin.
Also, this is the most fun podcasting I've done in ages. I've really enjoyed this. We've had a really nice chat. So like, bring Adrian Childs in and
to your podcast,
get your multivitamins. Like, that's what would Adrian Childs do? He would have a multivitamin. Do you know what, Tom? I'm going to go and have a multivitamin. And you at home,
treat yourself.
I'm not allowed to make medical recommendations, but if you like taking multivitamins, go and have a multivitamin.
I have to take them because I don't go outside enough.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.